And so we are here to welcome Aaron Young today to the podium, and he will be sharing his experience as managing director and as an aficionado of Shakespeare and a scholar of sorts, I'm sure. And we're delighted to have this as part of our Sharing Our Hearts Through the Arts theme. And we will have a little time for Q&A after the talk. And so I welcome Aaron Young.
Thank you. It's an honor to be invited to speak with you today, and I hope I don't disappoint. My name's Aaron, as you know, and I have been in Winona now for 8 years as managing director at Great River. I have been a theater producer for about 26 years. In venues around the country, love the art of theater and what it does for bringing together a diverse community. And in a lot of ways, Shakespeare, back up a little bit. I'm the treasurer of an international organization called the Shakespeare Theater Association. It's about 125 theaters around the country, around the world, that primarily produce the works of William Shakespeare. And at our conference, which was in San Francisco last month, we had a discussion about why we produce Shakespeare. And Shakespeare has the ability to gather people from all walks of life, all different political views, all different financial strata, because Shakespeare's works speak to our common humanity and the thing that makes us whole as a community. In a lot of respects, it's people who do that today are Shakespeare and Dolly Parton. As an announcement, I haven't officially made this announcement, but Winona will actually be hosting the International Shakespeare Theater Association Conference in 2028, so 3 years from now. And so we're very excited and hope that you all will fully embrace these theater producers. But another reason that we talked about why Shakespeare is that Shakespeare is not copyrighted. And so as a result, his works that really express great humanity, we have the ability as theater producers to adapt them to meet the situations that we're in now. We don't change the language, but we piece together different things. We sometimes weave in other parts of Shakespeare's text from other plays or from his sonnets that are going to address the issues that go on in our society. So Shakespeare is current events as well as 400-year-old events, but has always been popular in America. I do want to mention something here about theater as a whole. It is a gathering place for all different parts of society. And in Shakespeare's day, the royalty and the common people were in the same venue, in the same theater. And in the early days of American theater, this was the case as well. Theater was performed with the lights on. There was a relationship between the artists and the audience that was very palpable because you were all part of a communal experience together. There was a lot of direct address, which is part of Shakespeare, where the actors are speaking directly to their audience and expressing their thoughts and minds. Nowadays, we have that in film. It's done silently, but we have close-ups on people's expressions, and we have music that comes in and weaves in the feelings. But back in Shakespeare's day, everything had to be communicated with words. Audience behavior was expected and encouraged. And as you can see here, it is sometimes riotous. It is not peaceful sitting in the pews. And I want to point out here on this picture on your right, notice along the edge here, the spikes, right there. The spikes there, separating the audience and the artists as well. Sometimes things got unruly, even among, you know, our well-wigged society. We The theater was sanctioned by the royalty, Royal Theater, Drury Lane and Covent Garden, which is in Covent Garden, was a great place for people to gather in England. But that is where American theater came from. Theater at the time, in the early days of the colonies, was not homegrown. It was imported. Productions from London would come and tour around the colonies, and that was where art came from. It was not always peaceful. This is a picture of a riot that happened in the Royal Theatre, Drury Lane, on February 24th, 1763. This was what was written in Gentleman's Magazine. "The mischief done was the greatest ever known on any occasion of the like kind. All the benches of the boxes and pit being entirely tore up, the glasses and chandeliers broken, and the linings of the boxes cut to pieces. The rashness of the rioters was so great that they cut away the wooden pillars between the boxes. So if the inside of them had not been iron, they would have brought down the galleries upon their heads." The reason for the riot, people broke into the theater during the course of the play, and the reason that they were protesting was because the theater had abolished their half-price admission policy. So people do not want to be separated from their theater. And acts of theater producers that separate people from the opportunity to gather and experience something together creates dissension and separation in our society. Shakespeare was the great, in the 19th century, it was the great icon of Anglo-Saxon culture. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, for instance, in his journal, that beings on other planets probably called the Earth Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was so prevalent. His plays weren't just the favorites of the nobility or the educated. In Gold Rush, California, miners whiled away the harsh winter months by sitting around campfires and acting out Shakespeare's plays from memory. His words were well known throughout every stratum of society. The greats like Sarah Bernhardt all studied Shakespeare. And this person in particular we're going to talk about, his name is Edwin Forrest. Edwin Forrest was America's, so we had imported actors from London. Edwin Forrest was America's first prominent actor and gained quite a following and performed. He has a statue that is in the Walnut Street Theater. He was born in Philadelphia. There's a theater to this day named the Forrest Theater in Philadelphia. But this is a statue of him that is in the Walnut Street Theater, where I've seen it quite a number of times. And I just have to comment that, doesn't that look like Ron Swanson? It's amazingly similar. But Edwin Forrest, he was so popular that he even toured in England. And he did two tours of England. Meanwhile, England's predominant Shakespearean actor was a man named William Charles Macready. And he came and toured America a number of times. He was so popular on his first tour that when he came around his second tour, Edwin Forrest booked plays in every city that Charles Macready appeared. Doing the same play. So if William Charles Macready was doing Hamlet in Philadelphia, Edwin Forrest booked a production of Hamlet in Philadelphia. The same thing in Colorado, you know, then Edwin Forrest was in Colorado and he went everywhere that William Charles Macready went to create some conflict. Does this go backward? No. Previous, boom, oh. So on William Charles Macready's second tour in England, or when Edwin Forrest's second tour in England, he was not as well received as his first tour. And so he blamed that on William Charles McCreedy. He said, he's poisoned the populace against me. And he believed that that everything was bad. When he went on, he was hissed by the audience, and McCreedy told everyone that Edwin Forrest was without taste. When William Charles McCreedy came back to America for his third time, that's when it created quite a clash, because things had grown quite dire. At the time, Edwin Forrest was going through a divorce. His wife was British, and he claimed that his wife had been unfaithful to him, and it was a scandal, just like any celebrity scandal in America today. It was well publicized, and it created a lot of dissension between the British feelings and American feelings. At the time in America, the British hatred was pretty strong. The only thing that England and America could unite against was their hatred of the Irish. So it was quite a difficult time. A Tale of Two Theaters. At the time in New York, there were two prominent theaters. Edwin Forrest got his start here at the Bowery Theater. This was a theater that was built to entertain the common man. So there were a lot of things that they did. They focused on animal acts, minstrel shows, melodrama, and hybrid forms such as melodramas about dogs saving their human masters. These became unprecedented successes at this theater. They introduced gas lighting in lieu of candles and kerosene lamps, and it got the nickname the Slaughterhouse for its low-class offerings. Terms like Bowery melodrama and Bowery actors were coined and became commonplace to denote that this was entertainment for the masses, for the lower levels of American social society. Meanwhile, the upper class built what was called the Astor Opera House. And this is down in the financial district of New York City, where all these things, this was before Broadway had moved up to the Times Square area. And this was for the attracting only the best patrons, the upper tens of New York society, who were increasingly turning out to see European singers who appeared elsewhere in town. They expected that the Opera House would be a substitution for the general drawing room, a refined place where ill manners were infrequent, and where you might gather to enjoy a nice, courteous evening. In pursuit of that, they made some practices common in the Astor Opera House. The benches on the lower level were all replaced with upholstered seats. Every theater in New York just had hard wooden benches, but the Astor Opera House had upholstered seats. They were available only by subscription, and there were two tiers of boxes. Then there were 500 general admission seats on the third level. And this third level only had benches, and it was in what was called the Cock Loft. It was only reachable by a narrow stairway that was otherwise isolated from the gentry below. So it had a separate entrance from the exterior. There was an enforced dress code, which required freshly shaven faces, evening dress, and kid gloves. It had failed within the first year. They weren't able to attract enough people to keep the opera going, so they decided that they were going to bring theater. So they invited William Charles McCreedy to come and perform Hamlet in May of 1849. Macbeth. At the same time, Edwin Forrest was doing Macbeth in a huge Broadway theater. Three nights before the riot, so the first performance of Macbeth on May 7th, there were Edwin Forrest supporters had bought all the tickets for the gallery, the 500 seats up in the gallery, and they came armed. It says here, the quote is, they threw to the stage rotten eggs, potatoes, rotten eggs, potatoes, apples, lemons, shoes, bottles of stinking liquid, and ripped up seats. But nevertheless, the performers persisted in performing. The audience shouted shame, shame from down below, while upstairs they shouted down with the codfish aristocracy. But the actors were forced to perform Macbeth in pantomime as they couldn't hear themselves above the crowd. Meanwhile, at Edwin Forrest's performance of Macbeth in the Broadway theater, the audience rose and cheered when Forrest spoke Macbeth's line, "What rhubarb, senna, or what purgative drug will scour these English hence?" So after this disastrous performance, MacReady was ready to leave. He was booked to perform a number of performances, but he said, "That's it, I'm out of here, I am leaving America." But a petition was circulated and signed by 47 very well-heeled New Yorkers, including authors Herman Melville and Washington Irving, who both informed the actor that, quote, "good sense and respect for order prevailing in this community will sustain you on the subsequent nights of your performance." So on May 10th, he again took the stage, and the audience was ready again. Leaflets had circulated throughout the community that they were going to disrupt the performance again, and they wanted people to show up in support of America. We want American actors performing our Shakespeare. The government got word of it, and the local troops were called out, and for the first time, the New York militia was called into service. This was the first effort of the New York militia, bringing out 350 men who were added to the 100 policemen outside the theater. By the time the 7:30 performance began, there were 10,000 people in the courtyard in front of the theater. Meanwhile, the performance is going on inside. They had circulated tickets, fake tickets, to the gallery again, but they had been prevented from entering, but some people broke in. MacReady had to perform in dumb show, and then at the end of the performance slipped out in disguise. It was scheduled to start at 7:30. At 9:15, the confusion started outside, so you know that he performed it in pantomime and didn't speak all the words because they were done in less than 2 hours, which you know is not happening in Shakespeare. So the militia was there to control the crowd, only to be jostled, attacked, and injured. Finally, the soldiers lined up and exclaimed some unheard warnings, shot a first round into the air and a second round point blank into the crowd, immediately killing dozens at point blank range. New York Tribune reported, as one window after another cracked and pieces of bricks and paving stones rattled in on the terraces and lobbies, the confusion increased till the Opera House resembled a fortress besieged by an invading army rather than a place meant for the peaceful amusement of civilized community. The next day, a meeting was held at City Hall, which was attended by thousands, with speakers crying out for revenge against the authorities whose actions they held responsible for the fatalities. During the melee, a young boy was killed during the meeting. An angry crowd headed up Broadway toward Astor Place and fought running battles with mounted troops from behind improvised barricades, but this time the authorities quickly got the upper hand. All in all, between 22 and 31 rioters were killed, 48 were wounded, 50 to 70 policemen were injured, and of the militia, 141 were injured by various thrown missiles. They laid dead bodies out on the streets for families to come and identify them. This was a dividing point in American culture. And Shakespeare, at that point, went from being recited around campfires by minors to being relegated to the educated upper class. Shakespeare became a subject that was taught in university and was actually used as a litmus test when colonizing America. We, as a country, use Shakespeare. We perform Shakespeare for the Native American populations, and if the Native Americans laughed at the appropriate moments or cried at the appropriate moments, they were deemed civilized tribes, and otherwise they were deemed as savage tribes. So Shakespeare's got a really bad rap in America, and a lot of it stems from the polarization that happened in nationalism of separating England and America and trying to claim who was the right in performing Shakespeare. Nigel Cliff wrote in the Shakespeare Riots that the riots furthered the process of class alienation and segregation in America. As part of that process, the entertainment world separated into respectable and working class orbits. As professionals, actors gravitated to respectable theaters, and vaudeville houses responded by mounting skits on serious Shakespeare, so the Saturday Night Live of its day. Shakespeare was gradually removed from popular culture into a new category of highbrow entertainment. Meanwhile, what came of the Astor Opera House? It, within 3 years, was turned into the New York Mercantile Library, and within the next 30 years was torn down completely and is now replaced by an apartment building. So, nice heavy thoughts for us on a Sunday morning, but I would like us to think about some things. Should all factors of society gather together for entertainment and culture, or should we be separated? In America right now, we separate ourselves by doing it in our own living rooms with our remote controls. But it's important to gather together. We experience that here together. And should we all gather together for our culture? I argue yes. What are the benefits of gathering together, and what are the drawbacks of gathering together? Because we don't all agree, but yet we can experience the same thing. Our artistic director likes to say when he's sitting in a theater and the person next to him is crying and he's not, and they're experiencing the same thing, he says, I have a different perspective on what is happening than this person next to me does. And both are equally valid, and both need to be celebrated. So it's important that we are together. Can Shakespeare return to a place of popular culture? I think Winona has proved that. I think we have a great gathering here. What obstacles do we throw up, intentionally or unintentionally, to limit those who participate in the arts? The arts are free. The artistic expression that an artist does is a free will offering, a communication of ideas and thoughts. It can be commodified and it can be turned into a painting that is auctioned, but the creation of that painting was done as a free will offering by the artist. We can create a ticket to come see a particular performance of a play, but the thoughts and the ideas and the emotions expressed in that play are free will offerings. So what obstacles do we put up that keep people separated from those experiences and from hearing an artist's free will offering? And how can I, as an individual, support the free exchange of ideas in my community? So that's what I would love for us to think about here as we walk away from riots that happen. I created this presentation in 2018 before the George Floyd murder and riots, before the January 6th riots. And at the time, riots were a thing of history. You know, I had heard about race riots in the 60s. I had heard about, you know, this riot in New York. I had heard riots over the Rite of Spring musical piece that happened. But I hadn't experienced riots. And now I've experienced riots and I've seen the effect and the devastation, which is never good, and results in polarization. So how do we combat that? I, of course, think that we combat that by coming into the theater and celebrating Shakespeare. But what can we do as community members to make sure that those ideas are circulating and not staying in individual camps? So with that, I entertain any questions you might have. Yes.
So first of all, I didn't know that story, and if you had asked me to make up a story about how we got to where we are, I probably would have made up that story, so it makes sense. Aaron and I sing together in the Winona Community Chorale, and I have kind of struggled a little bit with our programming in that organization because we do a lot of, you know, pop-type music and such as opposed to more traditional choral music, whether it's sacred music or more modern stuff. But now I don't know, this story helped me see the benefit of, you know, reaching out, you know, to a broader community to make arts more broadly available where you can do both and people can be exposed to more and sort of be brought into the arts and try to break down that sort of, I don't know, class wall. Your presentation helped me see the benefit of kind of our programming in the choir. Related to that, for Shakespeare, that my actual question, that's all lead up to this, is, you know, for me, the barrier to Shakespeare has always been language, and I'm sure that's true of a lot of people. And honestly, interestingly, related to the topic of your conversation, not understanding it makes me feel like less than, and or not educated or whatever it is, and I kind of like resist that. So I wonder, like, regardless of class, like what is your take on helping to break down that wall and to make, I don't know if it's earlier education or what it is, but to break down that language barrier so that it is more accessible and you can actually weed through the language barrier to get to the core ideas he's trying to communicate.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And plays right into our mission. Our mission is to make sure that Shakespeare is understandable. And relegating it to English classes, I love English classes, but Shakespeare was written to be seen, to be, you know, experienced. And I can, the written word is one tool. My vocal inflection is another tool. The use of my body is another tool. And my relationship with other people in a space is another tool. What I'm wearing on stage and how it represents who I am is another tool. The music is another tool. The lighting effects are another tool to help focus us. In theater, we use all of these tools to help make sure that everything is understandable. So I would say the solution is exposure. Just like you talked about exposure to different musical styles, exposure to Shakespeare, and don't give up if it's tough to understand, keep coming. And Shakespeare is full of double entendre and even triple entendre. And our actors were discussing that and people were saying you can't communicate triple entendre, you know, that there's three different parties on stage and I'm saying something and it means something different to all three people because I'm playing them against each other. This is the strategy that goes on in Shakespeare's world and in a lot of royal games. And so there's one thing that is said that means three different things to three different people. That's really confusing when you're just seeing it on the page. We spend at the Shakespeare Festival as much time rehearsing as we do performing. So we typically spend 6 weeks rehearsing the plays. That in America is unprecedented right now. Most plays, in the 26 years that I was a theater producer, most plays went up in 2.5 weeks. And the difference is that we're studying it and making sure, what does this mean and how is it being communicated? And making sure we're using all of those tools to communicate all of those messages. And so exposure is great, but exposure to the Great River Shakespeare Festival is really going to do it for you. You know, and when we started, people came up and they said, thank you for retranslating the text and making it easier to understand. And we didn't change a word. It's just we spent time to make sure that we were delivering it. There was an article that came out in the Washington Post about 5 years ago that said, modern audience is too dumb to appreciate the brilliance of Shakespeare. And I was pissed, because I thought, this is a theater critic writing this, and I thought, it's not the audiences, but it's the actors who are lazy. if the actors do not do the work to make sure that they know what they're saying, then there's going to be problems. And I'll share the tea here with you. We did a production of As You Like It two, three years ago. And after this show was over, one of the actors came up to me and confessed, I was petrified on stage every night because I knew that there were other actors on stage who had no idea what they were saying because we didn't spend the time in rehearsal working through some really complex moments. And she said that was a failing on our part. So we actually went back and we said we need to make sure and we're doing more in rehearsal because, you know, that actor felt trapped on stage because they had no idea what was going to, they knew the words that the person was going to say, but the meaning behind those words was different every night. And so she was petrified on stage. So very fascinating. Yes, I could go on.
Now, speaking of actors, do you think American actors are disadvantaged because we don't have anything like the Shakespeare Company that have in England that trains actors from a young age? When you're watching film versions these days of Shakespeare with British and American actors, it's almost embarrassing for the American actors. They're speaking the lines, but you don't think they know what they're talking about.
Yes.
At the same time, and it's like two different plays going on. And how can you basically train actors these days to start in Shakespeare young, at least, to understand more of the plays and to kind of grow into the roles, if you will?
Yeah. That exposure is really important. I spent most of my career producing musicals, and I thought I'm not going to do this Shakespeare thing. I don't like the language. And then I realized that Shakespeare is a musical. It's all heightened language. It's all heightened emotions. And so being comfortable with heightened language and is something that the actors need to do. We are very lax in America in our entertainment and in our way of speaking. Our vocabulary is maybe a fifth of what Shakespeare's vocabulary was. And so we're not using the words. So that exposure is really important. Looking, you know, watching the BBC, you know, and PBS is really a great thing to do for children because in other cultures, they don't abandon their classic language. You know, when I read Shakespeare's, you know, in Henry V, there's long sections that are in French. And then there's the English stuff. And I struggle with the English stuff, but I speak French as well. And when I read the French, it's like, oh, it's easy. It is easy. And that's because the French language has not formed away from its origins as much as as English has here in America. So exposing yourself to other cultures and the way that they speak is really important. A lot of our actors study in England, and it helps kind of expand their horizons. Yes, Leslie.
Does the festival have data on your audience members and how that has changed or not over the years in terms of bringing in, you know, a diverse class of audience members?
So we have demographic data about where people are from, but we don't have data about household income. We've started collecting that about 5 years ago, and we've seen, you know, that it's been kind of solid. It hasn't altered much even through the pandemic, but we don't have historical, you know, beyond the last 5 years. So, but it is interesting to see, you know, I think the last study, it was like, 60% of our audience have advanced degrees. It's a master's degree or a doctorate degree. And that was something that absolutely shocked me. But we also have, 25% are living below the poverty level. Are those two things correlated? Could be.
What drew you away from doing musicals about Shakespeare? How'd you find your passion for Shakespeare?
Yeah, so for me, the passion came in the bigness of, you know, in a musical, you know, a well-written musical, the text is building up to an emotional point that you have no alternative except to sing. And in Shakespeare, it is that passion from the moment the first word is spoken. There is something urgent going on, and that's just what captures me about Shakespeare. I came to Great River Shakespeare Festival with a lot of faith. I knew three people: Paul Barnes, who had founded the company, Tara Flanagan, who I had worked with at a theater in Pennsylvania, and Christopher Gerson, who I'd also worked with. And I thought, okay, if they're involved, it must be good, but I had no idea what to expect. So I worked here for 7 months before I saw the first performance. And I just hoped it was good, but I was like, this could be really, really bad, but I'm very happy with how it turned out. A couple years ago at the theater I was at in Pennsylvania, we did Dial M for Murder, and I don't know if you know that show, but the woman is going to get stabbed by the man who's hiding behind the curtains in the study in her house, and the difference between watching that in a movie theater, they have to manipulate your emotions with music or whatnot, but to watch that as an audience member when it's happening and there are 500 people in the theater and nobody says a word. Nobody says, he's behind you, look out, look out. That's what your natural instinct is, but you are suppressing your natural instinct in order to experience this play. That is, the term is called the willing suspension of disbelief. You're willing to let it go, but you are an active, complicit participant in her attack. And that creates a feeling in your body, whether you acknowledge it or not, you are complicit in that violence that is happening in front of you, and you are consuming it for education, for your own entertainment, and you're doing nothing to prevent it. In a movie, you know that you could scream, you could throw things at the screen, and nothing is going to change. It's going to be the exact same every night. But you could create a riot in that theater if you wanted, but you choose not to. And that engages you in a way that you can't be engaged in any other filmed or recorded experience. So that's what I think makes live theater so fascinating.
Just how would you respond to that?
Yeah, so for me, it's about building community. That's why we're members of society, and we don't build community by watching a program in our home. And watching a program in our home is great, but the truth is that community gets built when we talk about that with other people and we get them to watch it too, and then we discuss it. Theater just really makes that process happen faster. But the thing that I love about Winona over every place that I've produced theater my whole life is that I live a half a block from City Hall, and I can go to a city council meeting and I can talk as a citizen and I can talk as a representative of the arts, and I can engage in community in a very meaningful way. I can walk into a store and people know me as for what I do and who I am, and I know them. And the size of this is so much richer than it is in New York City or in Kansas City or where it not, because it is, you can actually do something about it. You can actually do, you can do art and then you can do something about it in your own community. And that's why I love Shakespeare and Winona.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Aaron.
We will now have a musical meditation followed